Truly, I really did like who I was, but I hated my body. I had this like sense of I will finally love myself when I fit society's expectations.
Oh, that's rough. That is rough. So you said in 2005 you got your first bariatric surgery. So one, what was it? And then what is your why? Like, what made you finally go and get bariatric surgery?
Well, I was married to a man who was an athlete, and he had been training to do an Ironman, and he loved me regardless of my size. He's a beautiful, loving person, and yet I always felt like I was not able to join him in his life.
Guess what, guys? I'm not a doctor. So if you're going to be making any major medical decisions, please consult your doctor. That includes diets, exercise, medications, and surgery. I love you guys, and be careful and consult your doctor.
Welcome back to Our Sleeve Life podcast. I am your host, Mel. And today we have a treat for you because, you know, it's January and I really wanted to talk to someone about bariatrics and coaching and motivation and how do we get through this first few months and stay motivated to where we don't drop off? Because that happens to a lot of us right now. So I am very excited to get Miss Kristen on because she is a bariatric patient and a bariatric life coach. This is so exciting. So welcome on to the show, Kristen.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here. Really.
Me too. So when we were talking offline, you told me you had two bariatric surgeries, actually. So let's get into it. Tell me all the things. Where did this journey start for you?
Well, it started probably when I was a kid and grew up watching my mom always dieting. And by the time I was about 15, I was convinced I was so overweight, and I wasn't. I just had big boots. I'm busty. But in my mind, that meant I was heavy. There was something wrong. And that began a lifelong diet and self-deprecating thoughts and beliefs about myself that went on for such a long time. And then in 2005 is when I had my first bariatric surgery.
So your mom did a lot of diets. Did she make you do any of those with her? Because I've heard of that before.
No, but there were always subtle comments. There are always little things, sometimes not so subtle, like I remember one time she told me, those jeans make your butt look big. And my response was, maybe my butt's just big. Maybe I have nothing to do with the jeans, you know. And little comments. I was in drill team. Like, you know, I noticed that you have a little bit more of a pudge than some of the other girls on the team when you're out there on the field. And there was just always this expectation that I needed to be thinner, that I wasn't quite right. So.
Got it. Yeah, that's understandable. I think a lot of our moms, especially if you're anywhere from the 90s younger, a lot of our moms dieted and a lot of our moms just had these comments and didn't really know that they were doing damage. So, because I still hear some of those comments in my head from my family. So it's hard for them to go away.
When I was born in 67, I'm 58 years old. And so it was right in the height of the TV media and everything. Like, you just had to be thin. You had to be that copper tone girl with the long blonde hair and the skinny little body. And I was never going to be that. At least I never believed that would be part of who I could be, because all of the comments, all the messaging I got was that this is hard and you can't do it. It's just always going to be overweight.
Yeah, I got the same message. So it did not change for almost 30, 40 years. It's wild. It's only like these last 10, maybe 20 years where it's acceptable. Like there is a body positivity whole movement. Because I know when I saw those photos, like Twiggy and the smaller ladies like that back then in the 90s, like for me, I'm like, I'm never going to look like that.
Right.
Like I have hips, like there's just no way. And so I felt very disconnected from like everything. Cause I was like, I'm not like any of these people. What do you do? So how did you combat that before you even got to the surgery side of this?
Oh, I don't think I combated it very well. I think I think I accepted what messages were given to me, which was, you're a great person, you're funny, you're intelligent and kind, and you're overweight, and you probably always will be, and you're going to struggle with your weight, and you can't eat carbs, and you need to eat celery. I think I just internalized all of that and just...
Hey, Sunshines, quick moment for real talk. If you're getting ready for bariatric surgery or you are somewhere in the messy middle of transformation, you already know the surgery is the easy part. It's everything else that gets overwhelming. That's why we've partnered with Pop Recovery Systems. They are not a doctor's office. They are not another app. They're an actual team of recovery experts who walk with you through the whole journey, from the pre-op nerves to the plastic stage, if you go that route. Pop gives you one-on-one support like mental health coaching, nutrition guidance, mobility help, wound healing tips, all personalized to your procedure. And honestly, they just make you feel less alone. Their community is full of people who get it, and their coaches show up for you in a way most of us wish we had the first time around. If you've been thinking, I wish someone could just tell me what's normal, what's not, Pop is literally that someone. You can book a free consult or join their community using the link in the show notes. Again, no pressure, just support when you need it.
You know, truly, I really did like who I was, but I hated my body. I had this like sense of, I will finally love myself when I fit society's expectations.
Oh, that's rough. That is rough. So you said in 2005, you got your first bariatric surgery. So one, what was it? And then what is your why? Like, what made you finally go and get bariatric surgery?
Well, I was married to a man who was an athlete, and he had been training to do an Ironman, and he loved me regardless of my size. He's a beautiful, loving person, and yet I always felt like I was not able to join him in his life. Like he would want to go for hikes and runs and bikes and all of this stuff, and it was painful. And, you know, starting in my early 20s, I started gaining 10, 15 pounds a year, you know, and I was up in my mid 200s and just, I was tired. I was tired all the time. And I didn't want to live life that way. I had friends who were active, and I was like, I want a different kind of life. And my kids were young, and I wanted to be able to engage with them and play more actively with them. I think a big breaking point for me was we had gone to, I think it was Disney World. It might have been Knott's Berry Farm, but we were in California, Disneyland. And I couldn't ride one of the rides because I was too big. And I remember holding tears back and telling myself, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay. And yet inside, just feeling crushed, crumbled. You know? And so then I started looking into the surgeries, and I wanted to do the least invasive, which at that time was the lap band, the little band they put around the top of your stomach. And they don't do that surgery much anymore. It has an 85% failure rate, meaning 85% of people are going to regain a majority of their weight back. At the time, I didn't know that. And so I got the surgery and I started losing weight, and I thought, this is it. This is it. But I didn't tell anyone. I told my husband, and I told one of my sisters, and nobody else.
Because
in the back of my brain, I had this thought, what if I fail? What if I can't do this? What if everybody's expecting me to lose weight and I fail at it? Then they're all going to be watching me and being like, she had bariatric surgery and she still couldn't lose weight, you know? And so I kept it very quiet.
I did the same. I was so scared of those comments and judgments and all the things, and being a walking statistic of like, oh, I regained everything. Like, and I was, that was like the biggest fear. And I would say that held on for me to not get it done for a little while too. Just the fear of people acting that way towards me. So Was your husband at the time very supportive of what you were doing? Was he helpful?
He was super supportive. And his whole thing was, I love you. I love your body. I love the person that you are. And if this will make you feel better about yourself and be happier, I completely support you. That was his whole attitude. And he really did. Except for that, because he was such an athlete, he could eat anything you wanted. And he would bring snacks and foods in that I probably would have been better not to have around me.
Yeah.
You know, but when I'd mention it, he'd hide them away and stuff. And then after a little while, they creep back out. I really can't blame my regain on him. I know exactly why I regained. And he was not a part of that, but he was very supportive.
I love that. I love that he was supportive and had your back and was there for you. Because I know people where it's not like that, unfortunately, right? Yeah. Which makes things a lot tougher, makes things a lot harder for the journey. I definitely see people reclusing when that happens, unfortunately. But you said that, you know, like you did have regain. So when you started the journey in 2005, what was your highest weight?
I think I hadn't weighed myself for a while. The highest weight recorded at the doctor's office before my surgery was 267.
Okay. So what did the lap band at least get you down to, like 200? Like, what did it help you with?
So I got banned and I didn't lose really super fast, but I was losing steadily. And I got down to 193, I think, was my lowest.
Nice. Okay.
But literally, I hit that the wonderland, mm-hmm. and within about 3 weeks, I had turned course, and I was starting to sabotage myself because I started getting compliments from men.
Okay,
I had a lot of fear about that, and I don't need to go into that, but I felt like I was safest if I was heavier. If I was invisible to men, my life would be a lot easier. And so it was, I remember coming home from church one day and opening the fridge and just started eating. And I don't know that it was conscious. It was just, I feel terrified right now and this will help me.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, I've heard of that before. It sounds like you have trauma around that. I that's not fun to have to deal with things like that. Because I know lots of women, that's really one of the things that we gain a lot of weight to feel protected. It's like a defense mechanism.
Yeah.
A lot of us have had trauma in our younger years, which, like my Aunt Jolynn, like she unfortunately had a lot of sexual assault in her childhood. And what made her get to almost 400 pounds, she was just like, if I eat, then no one will touch me. No one will hurt me. No one will, you know, do anything to me. And that's how she copes. So I totally understand that like dynamic or that brain like thought process, because the world's scary. Like, it really is. And if you know what can work for you, then it happens. So,
and I think for me, for a very long time, it was subconscious. I didn't realize I was doing that. It wasn't until that day when I got very innocent comments. Like one of my friend's husbands, he just said, hey, you look great. You look like you've been working out. And instead of feeling like, oh, thanks for noticing. Yeah, I have been. I felt like, you can see me?
Yeah.
Don't look at me. Don't look at me. And I slowly sabotage. And then shortly after that, my marriage, we ended up getting divorced. And then my dad died a year later and life got hard. And when life gets hard, we go back to what we know. All of that messaging we've had all throughout our life is still there. That's the default messaging. And you can only focus on dieting and exercising or going to school or raising kids or dealing with finances or building a house or whatever. You can only focus on that for so long and also be trying to control what you're eating and everything. before your brain goes, I can't do it both. We're going back to the default messaging. You feel stressed? Go eat a donut chick. That'll make you feel better.
Yeah.
You know? Yep. And that's exactly what happened. It was that old messaging coming in, like, food is comforting. I can numb the painful emotions with food. I can distract myself from all of this chaos with a bowl of popcorn or, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I feel you. Did you feel like, did you know that that's what you're doing in the moment? Or is that something that you figured out later?
I was aware and actively trying to ignore it.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So it's that I know what I'm doing is trying to numb pain. I know I'm doing something that is sabotaging what I truly want in life. And I'm going to pretend like I don't know that because right now there's so much heaviness and I don't know any other way to soothe this. I don't know how else to do it.
Well, what it sounds like, I mean, is obviously you did a full 180 later on in life. So when did that happen? When did that start?
So I started gaining weight. I had my lap band surgery in 2005. My husband and I separated in 2008. By that time, I had started snowboarding. I was hanging out with my kids and doing more. I had lost weight. I was feeling better. And then my dad died shortly after the divorce. And that's when I started really gaining weight. And in 2014, my youngest graduated from high school. And I had always told myself, when my youngest graduates, I'm going back to school. I want to become a mental health counselor. I knew that's what I'd wanted to do for so long. So I got into grad school, and I think it was our second semester, we had a whole class on neuroplasticity, which is the brain's ability to continue to change and adapt over time, to build new neural pathways, you know. So basically, a lot of people say your brain stops growing at the age of 25 or stops. That's bullshit. Like, by 25, most of the brain regions are pretty much online and functional.
Yeah.
But we change throughout our entire life, you know. And so started learning about that. And then I started thinking of all the comments I read in the lap band support groups. And they were always things like, I got a band for my stomach. Now I need a band for my brain.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting in a class, and I don't remember what the professor said, but it came to me. The band for the brain is neuroplasticity. It's changing the way you think.
Yep.
And that started me down 3 years of intense research, looking at scientific studies, reading books, listening to podcasts, and just doing everything I could to learn about if my brain can continue to change. What is the most effective way to do that? And then I just started experimenting. And so, So in 2016, I had started really practicing some different kinds of techniques to change the way I believed about myself, the way I felt about food, the way I dealt with my emotions, all that kind of stuff. And I decided I was going to go back and get a revision to the sleeve. Because I had, by that time, I was I really don't know my highest weight. The highest weight I ever saw on the scale was 298. So,
from that one,
I probably hit 300 at some point, you know. So I had regained all that weight. I gained even more, and so I started the process for a revision to the gastric sleeve. And so I had that in 2017.
Oh, and nice.
Losing weight from that point on, it just felt natural. It felt instinctual. Yeah.
Well, you spoke about that you did some things to like reframe your brain to help you to get to that point. Can you give us any like tips or anything that you did beforehand to help with that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's a lot of talk out there about manifesting things, you know, manifesting this, manifesting that. And there's a lot of talk about positive self-affirmation.
Mm-hmm.
All of that is a part of it. But what I learned in the research is that the messages that we get from every moment of our life, every song we hear on the radio, every television commercial, every movie, all of those things, all the messages coming to us from our parents, our entire family's dynamic around food, and our family's dynamic around dealing with difficult things, all of those things create a default brain program that says, this is how I operate in the world.
Okay.
And so what I learned is that there are specific strategies you can do to basically prune out the messaging that isn't serving you and rewire good messaging in. And it sounds so simple, but the number one way is self-talk.
Okay.
Most people, when you ask them, like, what kinds of things do you say to yourself when you're angry or when you're disappointed? They'll say things like, I'm so stupid, or why did I do that? Or I always thought that. Oh, sorry. I always
No, you can cuss. No, you can cuss on the show. Don't you worry.
You know, so they'll have these responses that are not kind responses to themselves.
Right.
And so what all the research and everything shows is that when we can find self-compassion, when we can say, I love myself and I made a poor choice, and next time I'm going to handle it this way, that our brain starts to see us. It sounds silly. I think of our brain as kind of like this separate little entity that lives up in here that influence, and it influences us. So I kind of talk about it as third person, but our brain.
No, I like it.
Our brain sees us doing this stuff, and it says, oh, maybe I'm not stupid. Mm-hmm. Maybe in that moment I was reacting to an uncomfortable emotion, you know? And so one of the very first phrases I started with was, if other people deserve love, then I also deserve love.
Yep.
And I started with that phrase because I tried starting with, I love myself. And that just felt like I was lying to myself. My brain was just like, nah, you love parts of yourself, but you don't really love yourself. So I started like shifting into different ways. But what I have found is the most effective strategy is finding a core set of strength-based phrases that you repeat over and over and over and over and over to yourself.
Okay.
And then, like in my coaching program, I teach all the different ways of phrasing things. So you could say things like, you know, I should work out today. Should, as you probably have heard because of the work that you do, mm-hmm. should is a shame word. It just, it's like, if I don't do it, something's wrong with me. I failed myself or whatever. So, you know, we talked about changing that to I could. I could work out today. Could means autonomy. Could means empowerment. I could do that. It doesn't mean I have to, but it is now an option. It's not an obligation. There's no value associated with it. It is an option of what I could do. So I could work out today. I could drink a glass of water instead of eating that slice of banana bread. I could do this. I could do that. And so we start with subtle shifts like that, and then we move on, and there's five different levels of self-talk. And the most empowering one, the one that seems to sink the deepest into our brains, are identity-based phrases. Things like, I am the kind of person who works out every day. And I also learned that in my research that when you say it out loud, as opposed to just thinking it, there are seven additional regions of your brain that are activated just by vocalizing it.
Is that why we feel better once we've actually said it out loud?
It could be, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, because like I had to admit that I regained a year ago. And once I admitted it out loud, I felt so much better.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and when more parts of our brains are activated around the same message, it's going to get wired in deeper because it's going to get wired into all of those different brain regions. So what happens is when you vocalize, there's a vibration that we don't normally sense. Our brain senses it. So the part of your brain that senses that vibration is activated. All of the vocal parts of your brain, all the things that are involved in creating vocalization are activated. All of the auditory parts of your brain are activated. There's so many different things that are activated mm-hmm. when you say it out loud. So when you say, I'm the kind of person who works out every day, and you say it out loud, your brain is receiving it 7 times more than it would be if you just thought it to yourself.
Wow. Wow, that's I love that information. Like, that is super powerful.
So empowering. It is amazing to me. And yeah, when we get to a good point, I'll share a little bit about my experience being down here in Mexico for the last 2 months and how that has really been powerful for me. It's just been hugely reinforcing.
I believe it. So now you're on the second surgery. You got sleeved. So how did you feel? Because it's completely different when you wake up from a lap band to a sleeve. So one, what made you choose the sleeve? And then how did you feel waking up?
I chose the sleeve because I had already found that my thoughts were guiding me towards healthy behaviors. Okay. So I didn't feel like I needed to go as far as the bypass. And my doctor was really supportive of the sleep. He said, I think you're a great candidate for that. Okay. They had to do some repair work. I had a hernia. The band had slipped and there was scar tissue. So when I woke up from the sleep, you know, to be honest, I really don't remember what those first few days were like other than the disappointment of I don't do artificial sweeteners. So having to find a good protein shake that wasn't sugar-free and getting my doctor to be on board with that, that was a little bit of a challenge.
I'm sure.
I just remember some of that discouragement. I remember one day once I had moved into purees and soft foods, eating scrambled eggs and literally eating like 3 bites. And crying, sitting at the kitchen table crying because I wanted more food. It tasted good and I wanted more food. So I remember all those like those disappointments where you're like, this is hard. This is, can I do this for the rest of my life?
Right.
Yeah, I'd already done it with the lap band, although I had learned early on how to sabotage the lap band, which was one of the reasons for the regain. But then there was also, I was practicing this messaging that was, I only eat until I'm full, and that food is not disappearing from the planet. I can have that food the next time I eat if I want. Yep. I can have it 15 times this month, but I'm only going to eat as much of it as my stomach can actually hold. And so there were enough positive messages coming through just kind of automatically that I think the healing from the sleeve was tons easier than the healing from the band because my brain was already there.
Which I talk about this all the time of like doing that prep work, you know, already starting the like, let's drink water, you know, a little bit before we eat, you know, make sure you have the timers on. So that way you can get in that mindset of, hey, we need to think about food differently, how it's going to actually absorb now. It's going to be, it's so different. Because my brother had the lap band and I think it's a lap band thing. You know, everybody seems to be able to figure out like how to manipulate it. And with sleeve, and he said this to me too, because he went from a band to sleeve, is that you can't manipulate a sleeve. Yeah. Like there's no way around it. Like you just don't. So you actually have to go through the steps. So you said something about protein shakes. So you want it to have sugar or you don't want it to have sugar?
I don't do well with artificial sweeteners.
Artificial sweeteners. Okay.
They just don't agree with me. The other day we were out walking and I'd already had lots of water and I was like, I need something with a little sugar. I need something with a little, you know, so I got a Coke. And it took me, I think, probably 12 hours to drink the whole can of Coke.
Yep.
Because It's really sweet, and I don't need a lot of it. I did want a little bit of Coke. I wanted a little bit of the caffeine. But I don't do artificial sweeteners. I think if I could do them without getting the headaches and things like that, it probably would have made my weight loss a little bit faster. But as it was, you know, I lost at a good rate, and I was happy with it. And I actually continue. I mean, up until, I don't know, I just had to buy new shorts the other day. I'm still apparently losing, you know, it's just so gradual now. Like, I think last year, I think I lost 6 pounds. So I don't even notice it. It's just my body is still just adjusting, you know? It's just like, oh, there's still a little weight here to lose, and the calorie deficit is just enough, or whatever it is, you know?
Oh, 100%. Like, that's what I tell people. It's like they think they only have that honeymoon period to, like, lose weight. And it's like, no, guys, like, I'm 10 years out. And I have lost weight, I have gained, regained, and I've relost that. So it's like, you can keep losing, it's just a different rate. And I was a slow loser. That's what I tell people, because they're like, well, how long does it take you to get to your goal weight? One, I still have yet to get to my goal weight. And my surgeon reminded me on an episode that she never gave me a weight to get to. And I was like, she's all, that was on you, Mel. And I was like, oh, she's not wrong. That was totally on me. And second, I was a slow loser. I probably lost about 2 to 3 pounds a month. And I was okay with that because I was losing still. Like, and it took me about almost a full 2 years to stop, like to actually hit a real stall that's like months at a time, to, you know, and you just have to keep adjusting. And then I actually sat in maintenance mode for 3 years where I didn't gain, didn't lose. I just sat at 192 for literally 3 years. It was wild. Mm-hmm. And then Jimmy John's came into my life and wrecked it. It wrecked it. So that Jimmy John's, man, the bread, it was really the bread. Like, that's what started it. Cause I'm not a sweets girl. I'm a bread. Like, I'm savory. So it's like, you know, fried food, it's bread, it's ranch, it's all that kind of stuff. So it's different for me. And that, I think that's important too. And you can probably talk to that. Like, you really need to figure out what are your trigger foods. So that way you can adjust to that during this lifelong journey, because it's not just over at the 1 year mark. Like, there's so much that actually happens at the 3 year mark, the 5 year mark, and then getting up into the numbers that me or you are on. Like, it just, it changes.
Yeah. I'm 8 years out. It will be 9 years in April. And one of the things I do, so I am a mental health counselor and I still do that. And for years, I worked a lot with the bariatric surgeons in our areas, and like, in a couple months, I'm doing the support group for the regional hospital in my hometown, and so they would refer patients to me, and I would help them, you know, before, during, and after surgery, and I switched to the coaching because mental health counseling is so heavily focused on the past. It's focused on healing those traumas, which I think is incredibly important. I think, you know, I had some shit I had to process before I was able to move on to a place where I could start to love myself enough to take care of myself. So I think both things are important, but I'm shifting more into the coaching because I love the forward focus. I love the, okay, we're doing this, we're doing this, we're doing this, we're doing this. And I've lost my train of thought. We're talking about the goal weight, the losing. I don't know. Maybe you can help me remember where I was.
Yeah. I mean, we were just basically just talking about how, like, people like me and you, when we're further out, like, everything changes. Like, it's not the same anymore. Yeah.
It's not. And I can eat. I literally can eat anything I want. When I go on these support groups and, you know, on Facebook, or, you know, I read comments. I just, there's a part of me that wants to say to them, you can eat anything you want.
You can.
And you also have to be wise about what you choose to eat. It's,
yes,
it is a choice, you know, and the number one self-talk phrase I use. And I say it to myself. I wake up in the morning. First thing I do, even before I sit up in bed, is I have about 5 to 8 phrases. I just speak them out loud. I just say them out loud. And one that has been consistent for 8 years now is, I'm the kind of person who only eats when I'm hungry and I stop when I'm full.
Oh, I like that.
I always say that. And I always say, I always eat protein first. And I do try to, now there are exceptions, but I try to always eat protein first because that mitigates the blood sugars from whatever carbs you're eating. Yep. And the carbs create the carb craving. So if you start with carbs, I mean, I learned from myself, it is just not worth it to me. It is not worth it to me to eat a carb-heavy meal because for the next 2 to 3 days, I'm going to be going, do we have any chips around here? Ooh, look at that nice soft loaf of French bread. Ooh, look at these sweets. Yeah. Look at what it's just not worth it to me. So as long as I start with protein first, one, the majority of my stomach is now full with the food that it needs, the healthy stuff. And whatever carbs I land on top of that cannot do nearly as much damage. And so those are kind of the self-talk phrases that I use. But as far as how things have shifted, yeah, in the early days, I adhered, man. Mm-hmm. I did what my doctor said. Other than I found protein shakes that they didn't have artificial sweeteners. They were not very sweet, though. They were mostly just protein, you know. It shifts so much. And you get to a point where I go out to dinner, and you've probably experienced this, where you go, especially in early days, you go out to dinner and you look at the things on the menu and you go, oh, I really want this. And I can only eat this much of it.
Yep.
And it's $15. I'll just share with somebody. And then you end up sharing with somebody and it wasn't what you wanted, you know. And over the years, I've learned that, you know what? 10 years ago, I would have bought that $15 menu item that I really wanted, and I would have eaten the whole thing. And that would have been unhealthy for me. And I can still buy that and eat what I want of it. And if I don't finish it all, it doesn't really matter. Like, sometimes I'll still share with people, but sometimes I'm like, no, I'm in the mood for this. And I know I'm not going to eat it all. And if somebody wants some of it, great. You know, so you get to a point where you start to like trust that you can make the best decisions for yourself and you can control your portion sizes and all of that. That's what I found. And the clients that I'm working with, who I've worked with for a long time, you know, most of them are mental health clients as opposed to the coaching clients, but I've been working with them throughout their surgeries. That's where they're at. They're like, yeah, I can eat what I want. I'm wise about it. I just take care of myself, you know? Self-love. Well,
and I think that's the biggest deal is like trusting yourself around the food, because a lot of the years we couldn't trust ourselves. Like we would literally just grab and go. And I've had that full experience that you're talking about where I'm like, I really want this, but also like, do I want to pay that amount? I might as well just share because then it's cheaper. And you're right. There's times where I've ate food where I'm like, don't really care for this, but I'm doing it just to do it because I don't want to do the other. And yeah. I've found the whole, like, I've really have gone to the point of like the whole put your stuff in a to-go box. So like that really helps, guys. That's a really good trick if you haven't heard of that before. Like legit, when you get your food, go, hey, can I get a to-go box? You can put whatever you don't want to eat there in the box. So that way you're not tempted. You're not looking at it. Because I know like when I look at food, I feel like it's talking to me. And I feel like it's like, oh, you can have more, Mel. It's fine. Just a couple more bites. What's it going to do to you? Right? Like that's what is playing on in my head. And so the box without seeing it, oh my God, does wonders for me. Because I noticed, like you're saying, like I can have, say I want a club sandwich. That used to be one of my favorite meals. Club sandwich with fries, right? But now it's like I ask them not to put that middle bread in. So that wipes away one of the breads. And then two, I will put the other half in the box. So now I'm eating just one section of the sandwich. And then later on, that'll be like my dinner. You know, like I'm getting two meals out of one now, and I'm separating them with time, with water, making sure that, you know, I'm not just right on top of each other. It's really about planning and trusting yourself after you get out of that first few years, because I was just like you, where I'm like, whatever the doctor says, that's what I'm doing. They are the expert. And then after the 2 year mark, I had to learn to trust myself. Like, I just had to be like, okay, Mel, what are we going to do here? Are we going to make the good decision? Are we going to flop on this one? And I really just had to do that with every meal. It wasn't just like a day thing. It was literally like what the next meal was going to be. Am I going to do protein first? And once you do protein first for long enough, your brain, like you're saying, really goes, oh, protein first.
Yeah.
That's just what we do now. Yep.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you talked about the trigger foods. For a long time, I was scared of donuts because that had been like, I would go to the store and I'd buy two donuts and they would be gone before I got home. You know, that was the earlier version of myself. That was a thing. So for years and years and years, I didn't have donuts. And then a Krispy Kreme opened up not so far from me. And I went there and I got a donut and I had like three bites. And I remember thinking, yeah, it's yummy. That's really good. I just don't really want or need anymore. Like, I don't think I have trigger food. I have trigger emotion. There are times when I find myself, you know, like I'll walk into the kitchen. Mm-hmm. And this is the power of the brain training. I'll walk into the kitchen and open the fridge. And then it is almost like a little audible voice saying, am I hungry? Mm-hmm. And I'm going, I am not hungry.
Yep.
Close it. And then this is my routine. I put my hand on my heart and I say, what do I need? What needs attention right now? And I will go and I'll do some deep breathing or some stretching or some tapping. I don't know if you're familiar with tapping, the emotional freedom technique.
I am, but can you explain that for the audience?
So there's a great app called the Tapping Solution that teaches you how to do it and everything. I'm not affiliated with them at all, but it is a form of, what I understand is like it's an offshoot of acupuncture and activating different energy meridians in your body. And it starts with just some gentle tapping. And usually I'll say something like, so when my partner left the other day, I was having a rough time. They was like, even though I'm sad about him leaving, I love and honor myself. Even though I feel this stress that I won't see him for 6 weeks, I love and honor myself, you know, whatever. And I do that. And then you just kind of tap around different parts of your body, your face and upper body.
Okay.
While you just talk through what you're going through. And I was like, it sucked that on Christmas Eve, we were searching for a phone on a crocodile infested island. It sucks that we didn't get to have our sunset. It sucks that we didn't get to go down to the beach and relax and not, you know, and I just talk myself through it. And when I'm done, I literally feel like I'm going to be okay.
Yeah.
Walking, I have no urge to eat. Food no longer soothes emotions. And that is one of my phrases is I eat food for nourishment, not for emotional regulation. Because food doesn't regulate emotions. Now, it does give you dopamine, which softens the edges of jaggedy emotion. Well, I think it just makes everything cozier, you know, like, but, so it's an excellent coping skill because food is extremely effective.
Yeah.
It's just that it's not an excellent coping skill because we rely on it far too often. Mm-hmm. We rely on it. And yet that is the only coping skill we have, you know. Anyway, I'm getting off track.
Basically, no, you're good.
What I do is my brain says to me, are you hungry? And then I answer my brain and I say, nope, I'm not hungry. I'm sad. And then I go and I deal with my sadness. Or, nope, I'm not hungry. I'm procrastinating because this next step I have to take for work or for whatever it is feels daunting and overwhelming. Okay, well, go take care of yourself. Go do some deep breathing. Go make some plans. Jot down some notes. Brainstorm. deal with that. Don't try and numb it with food. Don't distract it with food. So.
Well, and I want people to know that, like, we are, like, I'm 10 years out, she's 8 years out. So this stuff is, like, we've had to train ourselves. We had to do a lot of the work to get our brains to actually just automatically do these things. Yeah. I talk about halt all the time. And that means, like, when you're at your cupboards or your refrigerator or if you're on your phone looking at DoorDash, like, you legit need to halt yourself and stop and be like, why am I actually doing this? Like you're saying. And a lot of research that I found is like, you're either hungry, angry, lonely, and tired. That's what halt is. And then you
hungry, angry, what?
Lonely or tired.
Oh, lonely. Yeah.
And the lonely is the one that gets me. Like, that's the one that got me to regain. That's the one that got me to eat ice cream last night. Like, that the lonely one definitely gets me. But sometimes you actually are hungry, but you really have to check yourself and be like, am I hungry? Am I thirsty? Am I having some sort of emotion? You know, you don't actually have to say these things out loud to yourself. Just talk to yourself. You don't have to be at the fridge talking out loud to yourself. You can literally just think about it and do whatever you want to do. Like, don't worry about anybody in the house judging you or the next door neighbor or Joe Smo down the street. Like, whatever you want to do, like, you do it for yourself and make yourself feel better, because at the end of the day, all we have is ourselves. So that, why not? And do you want to feel good or do you not want to feel good? And that's kind of where I put myself at when I'm at the fridge, is like, is this going to make me feel good or is this going to make me feel icky? And if I say it's going to make me feel icky, then I just shut the door. I'm like, nope, hands off. And then if it makes me feel good, then like last night, I also, though, I did make steak and I had some broccoli and I had some rice. And that was my dinner and I loved it. And I ate the protein first, so everything else was slowly second. And then I did get lonely 3 hours later and I did get myself some ice cream. I did not win last night with that one, but I'm okay with it. I'm not going to beat myself up on it.
And that's the thing is that we are allowed to be human. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. There are definitely times I choose the unhealthy food. Absolutely. They're not frequent. And then it's no longer my primary course of action. It's the one-off. It's the, you know, in this moment, there is ice cream and I feel lonely and I just want something sweet and cold and comforting. And you know, and I think the other thing that happens over time is I think we get better at recognizing I can have ice cream and I can have it for emotional comfort and I can control how much of it I have.
Yep And that goes back again to trusting yourself.
Right.
Like, I know a lot of us, that's going to be one thing you're going to have to work on, is trusting yourself, because we all kind of got out of control, right? Like, especially us emotional eaters. I can't talk for everyone, but that's how I felt. I felt very out of control, compulsive almost, and to the point where I was like, why am I even eating this? Like, some of the stuff I was like, I don't even like this. Like, what am I doing? Like, you know, it could go awry. So it's very important to, you know, have some systems in place. And I'm a big opponent of having some sort of mental health person, whether that is a therapist or a life coach or someone that can just really hold you accountable, but also not judge you. I think that's the biggest deal.
Can I introduce you to somebody?
Yeah, of course.
This person is my accountability person.
Oh, guys, if you're on YouTube, you're about to see it.
And I don't know if it will come through.
Let me. Oh, wow.
On my phone. It's probably not a very good picture.
Who is that?
That is a photograph of me aged out to about the age of 90.
Okay.
So this is 90-year-old me. I don't know if you can see her very well.
I can. Yeah.
I have it framed. Sits here on my desk. And that is one of the other really big components of my coaching program is, you know, we all have a really strong why for why we did this. Mm-hmm. We all have a huge why. And one of my biggest whys is that someday she's going to be the person living in whatever body I created. I am not the same person I was 10 years ago. I am not. Now, my core personality, my core, you know, values, all of that is stayed. But I have different thoughts. I have different friends. I have different activities. I am a different person and definitely different than 20 years ago or 30 years ago. I promise you that in 10 years, I'm going to be a different person than I am right now.
Yeah.
But that person is 100% dependent on me, on present me, on the me today, the me that's going to get up and leave this room at the end of this podcast to give them a healthy, active, vibrant life. Vibrant is my favorite word. My counseling practice is vibrant life counseling.
Oh, I love it.
I want to have a vibrant life. And she's the one. And there have been times I sat down and held up my picture and I'm like, hey, okay, so this is what I'm dealing with. And I get this sense of, what memories do I want to create for her?
Yeah.
If I live to be 90, which I may not, but if I live to be 90, I don't want to be, I don't want my life to be small. Yeah. I know it will be different. I know that I will have limitations.
Yeah.
But I still want it to be big and vibrant. And the present me is responsible for that. And I love her so much. In fact, I'm not going to talk about it too much more because it will make me cry. I love this woman who I haven't met yet. Aww. But she is going to be amazing. And I am going to give her the best possible life I can.
I love that. Look at you. You can tell that, like, you've transformed over these years. And
absolutely.
And your mindset has really shifted because, like, you can see it on your face. So, again, go over to YouTube, guys. You can, one, see the 90-year-old her photo frame because I've never even thought of that. And that's a brilliant idea to have that. Because, like, my goal is to live at least 85 to 90. That's the goal. So whatever I can do now to do that, that's what we need to do.
Well, and think about it. When you have kids, you're a mom.
Yep.
When your kids were young, you sacrificed so much for them. You sacrificed sleep, energy. You sacrificed spending money that you could have done things for yourself. You sacrificed time. You sacrificed intimate moments with your partner or time with your friends. You sacrificed anything. You sacrificed your sanity. You probably had arguments with toddlers and teenagers that were super important in the moment and at the same time made you just go, oh, I cannot do this.
Yep.
And that is because they were 100% dependent on you. You have a newborn baby. If you don't take care of them, they're not going to survive.
That's right. And that's our job as moms, keep them on the planet. Like,
and if I don't take care of her, she's not going to survive. She is every bit as dependent on me as a brand new baby. And I just adore her. I cannot wait to meet her. I think she's going to be a kick-ass bitch who's walking on the beach with her friends. Maybe with a walker. Who knows? But yeah, I mean, your why is more than just what affects you right now. Mm-hmm. It is the entire rest of your life. And when you can form a strong bond to that future version of yourself, it helps. And my partner and I, we are fire artists. And we don't spin fire. We don't blow fire. We put fire on the body. And
what?
Yes. And it is beautiful and incredible. I don't have a photo available that I can hold up for you, but it is incredibly beautiful. And empowering. And I ask every person who we light on fire, I say, why do you want to be lit on fire? And they always have a reason. I want to get past this fear, or I want to have an experience that I think, you know, I'll never get this opportunity again. Or one of my very favorite was a woman that we met at a regional Burning Man event. And she'd had breast cancer and she'd had reconstructive surgery. And she said, mm-hmm. I want to reclaim my breasts. I want you to burn away the anger and the lost years and the sickness and the sorrow and the fear. I want all that gone. And I want to reclaim these as my breasts. And we did, and we lit her on fire, and we have beautiful, my partner is a photographer. Well, we have actually a whole crew when we go to Burning Man events, but our photographer took the most amazing photos of her. And she came back every day of that burn and said, okay, that sounds weird. She came back every day of the event. And one of the days, she and I just big, long hug, her crying, saying, I feel like I own my sexuality and my breasts again. I feel transformed.
I love that.
We have
that.
People say, I feel empowered. I feel courageous. We have, sometimes people just say, I feel sexy or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but I'll tell you what, if it weren't for her, I never would have done it, because I already knew her. I mean, I already knew what I know about her before this fire thing came into my life. And I was like, does she want these memories? Oh, hell yes, she wants these memories.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely she does. And it's been transformative. And
well, it really has to be.
That, yeah, when you can tap into something deeply passionate for yourself and for your future, and you can get your brain to give you the messages automatically. I mean, I honestly don't need to rely on willpower very often at all. I very rarely have to tell myself, nope, nope, don't do that. That's not good for
mm-hmm.
you. Because my brain just automatically propels me to do what I want. I remember so many times finding myself putting an empty cereal bowl in the sink in the kitchen, completely unaware of walking into the kitchen, pulling out the box of cereal, pulling out the bowl and the milk and doing that, and eating it, completely unaware of all of those things that I actually physically did. And now I'm putting this dirty dish away and realizing, oh my gosh, why am I doing this? Like you said.
Yeah, like autopilot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, autopilot. And now I find myself so often standing. I live in Idaho when I'm not here. Standing in my backyard or standing on my balcony, stretching and doing some deep breathing and being like, oh, okay, let's just take care of myself. Those were the moments I would have been eating cereal. Those were the moments I would have been making toast and slathering it with peanut butter and honey. Those were the moments I would have been snacking or scrolling on my phone or sitting on the couch eating popcorn and watching TV. None of which are bad things to do, but when you do it on autopilot and that's your coping skill, then your brain is sabotaging you.
Yeah, it really
and
is.
You shift that so that your brain is saying, hey, you're feeling really discouraged right now. Wouldn't it feel good to call a friend
mm-hmm.
instead of, wouldn't it feel good to eat this thing?
Yep.
And then you have this, wow, you have this future that you're looking forward to. It's a powerful and exciting thing. And I will send you some pictures of the fire stuff that we do.
I was going to say, I have to ask because I have to do our audience justice. What do you mean you're putting people on fire? Like, how does this work? How'd you get into this? Like, that's crazy.
Is it okay if I share our Instagram link so people can look and see what it looks like?
Oh, of course. Yeah, okay. We can have that. I'll have that linked below, guys. So don't worry. You can go check it out.
At Fireflow_Studios.
Okay.
Fireflow_Studios. You can see the pictures of what it looks like. We've been doing it for 3 years. We do it very, 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 very safely. We've probably lit over 400 people on fire and never had an injury other than on myself and or my partner. Because we practice everything on ourselves first. And the worst I've ever had is I got a couple of blisters once. So there's different types of playing with fire on the body. The one that you see on Fireflow Studios is we use a mixture of soapy water with some other things in it. And instead of filling bubbles with air, like blowing bubbles, we fill it with a flammable gas, usually propane or butane.
Okay. Okay.
So we make bubbles that are full of propane. And then we wet down the skin, and your body does this thing called the lead and frost effect, where it senses heat and it shoots out water vapor to protect you. So there's a lot of things. But we put water on the skin, and then we put the bubbles on the skin. Okay. And then we light it with a torch, and it burns. Usually, I shouldn't say it is on fire. I don't like using the word burn because people imagine burning. And most people don't even feel the heat. Seriously. Most people are like, oh my gosh, I didn't even feel that. It goes for about 1 to 3 seconds max. But as soon as we light it, we're taking 8 photos in a second and we wipe it off and it's gone.
And, nice.
It really is beautiful. It's empowering and it's fun. And then there's a different kind of fire play that where you put a line of alcohol on the body, like you might put a line right here, and then you light one end of it, and then you chase the flame with your hand. So it doesn't stay in one spot. And it just makes a little flame. It's just a little, you know, blue gold flame. And you can go all the way up and down the body if you're really skilled.
Wow.
I don't do that type. I have taught that. My partner and I have taught classes. I am his primary safety for that. I know all this. I could do it. I just choose not to. I prefer to be the person who's checking in with the person on the table and saying, how are you feeling? How's that? Do you like this? Do you want any hot spots? You know, like that. I like being the nurturer in that situation. But that's what we do. And I wouldn't have done it if it hadn't been for this 90-year-old woman who's coming down the pike, because she's going to have some fabulous memories.
Oh my goodness. That's incredible. I've never heard of anything like that, but I can see how that could be really healing.
It can be.
And that's something I would love to try, because that's just amazing. And like, I have a lot of things I'd love to burn off. So
Yeah. And you know, it depends on the intention. We did a wedding party photo shoot up in Sayulita, which is a beautiful little beach town up the coast. And we had the groom giving the bride the gift of fire. And, you know, so there's different intentions, whether you want just a really amazing photo or whether or not you want to heal something. And I think for me, some of what I've healed is the fear that I couldn't do things. Mm-hmm. You know, now I feel so much more confident. I can do things. I can lose weight and I can keep it off, and I can do it naturally and instinctively without having to rely on constant willpower or building up motivation. It just happens. And I know we're kind of running out of time. That's my experience in the last 2 months here, and I'm here till the end of April. It's been hard. My nephew died. A dear friend of mine found out that they don't have long to live. I've had some illness. I've lived with a partner for the first time in 17 years, like living in a new culture. It has been challenging.
I'm sure.
And yet, my default brain program is eat protein first, eat healthy, exercise every day. I live on the 6th floor and it's 90 stairs up and down each way. And I still do an additional workout to that every day, because that's just what my brain tells me to do. It's just how it is.
I love that. I love that. Well, thank you so much for being on with me. Is there any tips, any strategies that you want to give our audience before I let you go?
Yes. there are a couple of things I would recommend that you do. First of all, come up with 5 empowering statements. One of the things to remember is that when you say, I am a healthy person, your brain already knows what it means to be a healthy person. It already knows all it's heard it a million times. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to be specific about every single thing.
Okay.
But come up with some 5 good phrases, a couple of them that are very specific. For me, I still say every morning, and I only say it once. When I first started, I was saying them 30, 40 times a day. And I'd break it up in 5 or 10 chunks, you know. I always eat protein first. I only eat when I'm hungry. I stop when I'm full. I handle my emotions, I don't eat for emotions. A couple other phrases I use are just things like, I am powerful. I love myself. I am a fortress. Whatever. Find the phrases that fit for you. Say them out loud. Look at yourself in the mirror when you say them. And try saying them with different kinds of conviction. And if it doesn't feel true, phrase it in such a way that you can still accept it. Like, I am learning to be the kind of person who always starts with protein first. Well, I try to always start with it. Say it so that you can accept it, you know?
Okay.
Say it out loud. I would encourage you to say it 30 times a day. Break it up into 5 times in the morning, 5 times. You can do it in the shower. You can do it in the car. You can do it while you're sitting on the toilet. You can do it while you're cooking. You can do it while you're it's not like you have to sit down and meditate through this thing.
Right.
When your brain hears it, your brain pays attention. And the more your brain hears it, the more your brain goes, we're in a lot of this same message. Maybe we should start wiring this in. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's one thing. The next thing I would do is I would think about, what do you want for your future self? Think about who you were before. 10 years ago, I rarely meet somebody who says, yeah, I really haven't changed much. Most people say, yeah, I'm a pretty different person now. You know, 10 years ago, I would have been I would have been stopped up and rolled. You want to light me on fire?
Exactly. Exactly.
So think about what you want for your future self and, you know, find a photo that, I aged several photos, and some of them were when I was really heavy, and they were hard for me to look at. When I aged those ones out to 80, 85 years old, I looked at them and I was like, I don't want that for my future self. I had to go back in time to a photo where I looked happier. I have this huge smile, and, you know, and that's the one I aged. It also is helping me accept the age spots that are showing up on my face. And all of you,
good.
I don't even know what I'm going to look like at that age. So this is me becoming. I'm becoming as beautiful. So get a connection to your future self. The last thing I would say is, and we didn't really get a chance to talk about this, micro habits are your friend.
Okay.
When I say I work out every day, I define a workout as 12 reps of anything that is specifically done for the purpose of working out. So I don't get to count my 90 steps coming up to my apartment every day.
Right.
Because that's just part of living. It is a workout, but I don't get to count it.
Yes. It's
12 reps of anything, and make it small enough that you'll do it even when you're sick. I remember when I had COVID, laying in bed and being like, I haven't worked out yet today. There is a whale jumping right over there right now.
Oh my God. That's so cool.
I just got really distraught. I'm like, oh my God. When I had COVID, I remember laying in bed and being like, I didn't work out today, and thinking, I'm the kind of person who works out every day. That's just the kind of person I am. That's just what I do. So I did 12 Kegels, because you know what? I wasn't doing them for any other reason other than to work a muscle. And I counted it, and I gave myself that gold star in my brain and said, I worked out today. Because I'm the kind of person who works out every day. When I first started that, 90% of the time, I did my bare minimum.
Yeah.
Now, 90% of the time, I do a pretty decent workout. There are times I do 10 or 12. I mean, there are times I do 12 reps, and that's it. And I'm like, all right, that's good enough. It was a busy day. I'm calling it good. But it's a habit. In the last 8 years, I've probably missed working out probably less than 5 times a year.
That's amazing.
The workout is 12 reps.
Well, and so you define the workout. I love that. Like, you're telling people they define the workout, not what society says a workout is. That's very important.
I had one client, her minimum workout was 2 laps through the loop of her house, her kitchen, her dining room, her family room, her living room, her hallway back to her kitchen. 2 loops. She used a walker. She was elderly. She didn't. That was her workout. If she did that, she got to count it. And over time, she started doing more and more. And then she started walking down the street, you know. And so those are my 3 things. Talk to yourself out loud.
Yeah.
Talk to yourself powerfully. Don't put yourself down. If you find yourself saying, I'm stupid, stop it and say, no, I'm not stupid. I'm allowed to make mistakes. I'm allowed to have weak moments. And the next time, this is my plan. So talk to yourself kindly and give yourself those statements that program your brain to propel you towards your goals. Get connected to your future self and lean into micro goals.
I love it.
And yeah, those action steps alone, like if you seriously do it, you'll be amazed. You'll be amazed.
Oh, I believe it. I'm a big believer in doing the little habits, making yourself feel good. Like, I have to remind myself sometimes when I'm like self-talking negative, where I'm like, Mel, you didn't do a lot today. Like, this, you know, this is a kind of a wash day. And then I have to tell myself, no, let's list the things you've done today. And then once I get to a point, I'm like, oh, wait, I've done more than most people in a day. Like, and then I'm like, okay, we're fine now. Like, but you do have to talk to yourself. I would say that is the biggest key to this whole journey is talking to yourself. You're so right. And I didn't really think about it that way, but it is true. Like, if you can talk to yourself out loud in your head, whatever it is, I notice that I can talk myself down. I'm able to calm myself better. But it was really because of the surgery. I had to learn that. And it sounds like you did too. Like, we were coping with food. Now we can't, you know, like you crying at the table. I cried in my hallway of like, I can't have any more food. And I'm so upset. Like, what do I do? Like, I just didn't know what to do. Right. And so now with all the journey and things that we've been through, ups and downs and having therapists and whatever, has really taught us like, hey, stop being so mean to yourself.
Yeah.
Love yourself and talk to yourself. Because I meet people all the time that they just hate themselves. And it makes me so sad. Cause like, we can see the good in them. And I'm just like, please don't believe that. And so, and I've told people like, do you talk to yourself? And they're like, no, why would I do that? And I'm like, here's why.
Here's why.
And here's why. It's a big deal, guys. So if you don't take anything else away from this episode, just talking to yourself, do it. But there are so many good little tips and tricks and nuggets in this episode that I really love. I'm very happy that we finally got to hook up and do this podcast. So thank you again, Kristen. And we'll have all of her links below. I'll have her send me all those so that way you guys can check out her coaching. You can check out the Instagram. Look at the fire. Like, that's going to be cool. I know that's the first thing I'm going to do. So
you will see some. I don't think there might be some risque photos on there, but they're Instagram worthy. So, and I don't think there's any risque photos of me on there. There's bikini photos.
I think it's fine because you know what? You've earned that bikini, damn it.
Oh,
you wear that bikini. Yeah. Like, you've done the work. So I love it. Well, you guys all know, until next time, make sure you're eating that protein, drinking that water, getting the sleep. That's what that one is, like, hidden key. And of course, take your vitamins. I have mine right here from ProCare. I do take them. I even have the chews. And then lastly, don't be an asshole to one another, okay? So have a great week. Message us if you need anything. Bye.
Bye. Thank you, Mal. This was wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me on this episode of Our Sleep Life podcast. Don't forget to head over to my YouTube channel, hit the subscribe button, and follow me on all the socials so you stay connected. And remember, until next time, keep shining bright.